Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care with a focus on patient-centered care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD To The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. Today on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are looking ahead to 2015 and talking trends with local writer Neil Charles and Indie Food Swappers founder Suzanne Krowiak. We'll also look a couple of weeks into the future and hear about the upcoming Devour Downtown promotion from Susan Decker. And we'll also get a little insight into the Devour signature cocktail from local wine and spirits expert Arthur Black. And we'll head into the kitchen for a Cook This segment with private chef Megan McClanahan. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. It's cold, it's dreary, and you're going to need something to brighten up January and get you out of the house, right? Well, Devour Downtown certainly offers some great reasons to brave the cold and get out and about. The 14-day run of restaurant specials begins January the 19th, and this happens to be the 10th anniversary of the dining event. I caught up recently with Susan Decker, who promotes the event, for a few Devour details.
It's pretty cool to see the evolution over the last decade since we're celebrating our diamond anniversary for Devour, which is hard to believe, but we've grown from just starting out with a little over 20 restaurants to now more than 85. So it's really this great concept where all of these downtown entities and restaurants have come together to make this really cool, fun event.
So how has it changed over the years beyond the number?
Beyond the number, we've also added in some other partnerships and deals so people can go to devourdowntown.org and check out some special offers from some of our partners like the NCAA Hall of Champions, the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, just different ways to keep people downtown to stay and play.
When do you start working on Devour? Because, of course, we have Devour in the summer, too. Is it a constant year-round thing, or do you end one and start the next one? How does that work?
It is constant. You're continually recruiting. You're continually looking for sponsors, new ways to add in new products, new things, and just always trying to keep it fresh.
Do you increase the numbers of restaurants every year, is it holding steady? I mean, we've been getting so many new restaurants.
And that's the great thing about the indie restaurant scene. We are getting new restaurants, so we're continuing to increase the number, which just makes it even more attractive for people to come to Indianapolis.
Do you market this, for visitors or for people who live here or some kind of combination?
It's a combination. We definitely want all of the local people to come out and try their favorite restaurants or try something new and celebrate those special occasions. But it's also a great way for people in Cincinnati, Chicago, South Bend, Louisville to come to Indianapolis and experience our Hoosier hospitality.
But that's a lot of restaurants to fit in. Any advice?
It's hard. You've got to do your homework, really. And it's sitting down and picking out if you want to go somewhere new or somewhere you've been or just expanding your horizon. So it's tough. It's hard. I don't even like to do that because it takes so much time to figure out where you want to go.
Now, tell me what the price ranges are, because they're not all the same, and some have lunch specials. Mm-hmm. So what's the range that we can expect?
There are some lunch offerings that are $10 per person for the 10-year anniversary. We'd like the number 10, of course. There are some 2-for-20s, 2-for-25, 2-for-30, 2-for-35, 1-for-35, kind of all over the place, but a lot of great values for people to try.
Do you try to hit new places?
I definitely try to hit new places or places that I may not have been in a while. It's kind of my philosophy to go around to all of them. It's just a little tough to get to 85 in 2 weeks.
See, that always challenges me, because you see the big number, and then you think, oh, I want to go there, I want to go there. Oh, but I haven't been here, So I think it can be challenging for people. Is there anything people should know about it? Anything, any special promotions that beyond what we've talked about?
There's also the Conrad is offering an overnight stay that's also available on devourdowntown.org. Just a $149 night that people can take advantage of so they can stay downtown, go out to dinner, go out to lunch, go out to breakfast, then go out to lunch and dinner again. Just helping you kind of get as many restaurants in as you can.
And tell me again about the website and what people will find there.
It's devourdowntown.org, and on the website you can find a list of the restaurants and, of course, the menus, which is the most important part, but also links to the websites, phone numbers to go ahead and make those reservations if you need to do so.
Now, Devour Downtown typically offers a signature cocktail contest, and this year was no exception. I was happy to serve on a judging panel, which tasted a variety of cocktails created by participating Devour Downtown restaurants. Heading up the panel was spirits and wine expert Arthur Black of RNDC, which sponsored the contest. He was impressed with the winner, a tequila drink called a tequila martini, created by Barbie Gale of Harry and Izzy's.
The reason why the winning cocktail in the Best in Show resonated with me is it played to something I believe defines a great cocktail, which is the enhancement of the nature of the base ingredient, in this case an añejo tequila, that has an aggressive oak regimen that shows a lot of oak nuances in the way of vanilla and the caramel and chocolate and cocoa and coconut. And as Barbie dropped off the cocktail and started speaking to the ingredients, it became very clear that what I was about to put in my mouth was everything that I expect from a cocktail that has a base ingredient with tremendous flavor. That is, you play to it. You add in ingredients that will enhance the flavors of the natural base ingredient, the agave aged in oak. So it was a little bit boozy, which is cool because you can have boozy and balanced. The ingredients, the citrus elements added lift and a degree of a feminine nature to an otherwise boozy and masculine cocktail that was a little bit more winter focused. Overall, it was a brilliant cocktail. It was awesome.
So how did Harry and Izzy's Barbie Gale come up with the winning drink?
At Harry and Izzy's, we're allowed to experiment. Our bosses encourage us to come up with new drink recipes all the time. We had known about the categories for quite some time, so all of us bartenders and servers, if anyone had a recipe, then we all got together. I love chocolate. I love desserty. I love orange. So I just kind of put my favorite chocolate and orange together, and I added tequila with it. The Trey Generations Añejo is absolutely fabulous. It's very smooth. It's very masculine, but it's very feminine at the same time with the cocoa. The recipe would be 2 ounces of Trey Generations Añejo tequila. I used 1 ounce of Cointreau, and then I used a 1/2 ounce of dark cream de coco, blended that together into a martini glass, and garnished it with a slice of orange with cocoa powder.
For more information on Devour Downtown and to check out menus and deals and to plan your Devour Downtown strategy, go to devourdowntown.org. Food and wine are certainly a natural pairing, and local writer Neil Charles has combined the two throughout his career. You might remember his restaurant reviews in Nouveau News Weekly or follow his current writing on food and architecture now in Sophisticated Living. In any case, he brings a sharp eye to local trends, so I sat down with Neil recently to talk about wine, food, and what he anticipates for 2015.
Tell me about your food writing career, when you started, where it has gone, how it's evolved, that sort of thing.
So to start right at the beginning, I got seriously interested in food as a matter of necessity. I grew up with my grandparents. My grandmother was the worst cook on the planet. And then I went to an all-boys boarding school in England, and so one really had to learn to cook there because the institutional food was so horrible. So I developed a pretty serious interest in food at a very early age, and then so I was going through actually high school. I studied French there and was sent off to France to work in the wine industry for Alexis Lachine. And I got to hang out with some really prominent, interesting people in the wine business, and they got me interested in oysters and terrines and pâtés and classic French cooking, and I decided that was something I might become interested in later in life. So fast forward a few years, I moved to this country in 1987 and started working in the wine business, and that really has been my main profession ever since. And then I was writing for was just doing a newsletter, in fact, for a retailer I was working for, and this was spotted by a fellow who owned a local rag downtown. And that led to a job for about a year at IBJ. And I realized fairly early on, that this wasn't quite the outlet for me because, let's say, they didn't quite share the same sense of humor that I had, and I always like to inject a little bit of wit, if possible, into my pieces. But I was approached eventually by the wonderful duo, Jeff Parker and Jim Poyser, managing editor at Nouveau at the time, and Jim very generously offered me a position at Nouveau in, I think, 1998 or so. So it's been quite some time.
Was that a better fit for you than the IBJ?
Yeah, that was a great fit because I've always been something of an iconoclast, even though I had this very respectable kind of super bourgeois upbringing in England. I've always had a slightly rebellious streak, and I feel that Nouveau was the right way to go for me at the time.
But tell me now where you are writing now, which is very different from Nouveau.
That's right. Right now, I write, in fact, for the last 3 years, I've been writing about both houses, architecture, and about food for a Sophisticated Living magazine, which is based at the Carmel Design Center, writing for Jeff Cohen, wonderful fellow, great editor. And I joke frequently about, writing for the 99% and writing for the 1%, and the fact that one has to wear really different hats for both those roles. But I enjoy writing for Sophisticated Living. It's not as critical an outlet as Nouveau. Obviously, one doesn't get to flex one's opinionated critical musculature, but it's still fun going to great restaurants, talking to the people behind the scenes, and getting introduced really to a lot of people whose company I thoroughly enjoy.
Now, also tell me about your wine business, because you have your own wine business now. Is that right?
That's right. I've had many iterations in the wine industry, and I'm sort of like a serial entrepreneur. My wife Amy and I keep saying, this is it. We're not going to do any more businesses. But we had the opportunity about a year ago to go into partnership with a splendid chap who is an accountant at a big firm downtown. And we started a company called Knapsack Wines. And the purpose initially was to just bring wine in for our own consumption, because there's a lot of good wine out there which was not available in the Indiana market. So selfishly, we wanted to bring it in for ourselves. Now we found, as things do, inevitably it's gained its own momentum. And so now we have a selection of, I think, really extraordinary wines, which we sell to the restaurant and retail trade. And Knapsack is becoming a wonderful little business, and I'm really enjoying it.
Well, now tell me a little bit more about it. What sort of wines are you looking for?
Well, we set the bar very high for ourselves. We decided we were only going to be offering wines which were either organic, biodynamic, or sustainable in terms of the viticulture. We didn't want to be inundated with Me Too fuzzy animal labels or cooperative productions, mass-produced wines. There's too much of that on the market already. So we set a very high standard, and that so far has worked. It's difficult sometimes because you have to really turn your back on what could be quite a lucrative little earner. We just got approached by a producer in Argentina yesterday, in fact, but they don't fulfill our standards. So the answer to them is going to be quite simply, no, we can't do business with you. And those standards have always been very, very important to me, and we're going to stick with them.
Tell me a little bit about what you think about wine in Indiana, about the wine consumer or trends that you might see.
Trends in Indiana tend to be rather like food trends, I think, a little bit behind the times. We're a little bit slow to adapt here. There's a lot of great wine out there in this market already, and I know we're coming into an already competitive and fairly full field, but there's always room for quality. There are a couple of really fine distributors who are doing a great job, but even though they might be well established, are still having trouble getting their wines to the right people. And I'm not really sure that the exposure is there for very high quality, organic, sustainable kind of wines. It's always been an uphill battle. And I found wine education since I started 25 years ago, has always been an uphill battle. You know, we're always saying we're just about to turn the corner, and we just don't turn the corner.
What do you think about the wine consumer in Indiana? Getting more adventuresome or staying where they in their comfort zone? What do you think?
I think it's incremental. And, you know, they say in politics that you'll never change people's ideas. You just have to wait for people to die. And then new people come along and they might adopt new ideas. And I think it's kind of similar in the wine business too, or beer. I think people who are used to drinking, you know, light beers will always drink light beers. You have to wait for younger people to come along and drink the more adventurous beers. And with wine, I think it's the same. Those who were brought up in the 70s, early 80s on big oaky California Chardonnays will continue to drink those. And I know 15 years ago there was a movement that started, ABC, anything but Chardonnay. And it never really caught on because Chardonnay is the most widely planted grape there is, and that is not going to change. So I feel that as younger people become interested in wine, so I think will wine tastes change. But I think it is unlikely and really overambitious to imagine that we will ever change people's minds.
So the Oliver Soft Red will stay the largest selling wine in Indiana, you think?
I think it will do, yeah. I think the people who are seriously interested in different wines, let's say aromatic white wines from the Loire Valley in France, those people are few and far between. And there are far more Oliver Soft Red drinkers, and there always will be, because that satisfies a certain taste requirement. And whether that's strictly Midwestern or not, I don't know, but it seems to be the status quo, at least for right now. I think it's a mistake on the part of wine educators and wine distributors, people like myself, to think that we are responsible for educating people's palates. I think that's arrogant, to be honest. And I meet a lot of young people in the wine industry who say, you know, we're going to make a difference. We're going to teach people how, you know, we'll be the arbiter of their tastes. And I don't really think we have a right to do that. And I know there's a master of wine I know out in California who used to work for a big company that made sweet white Zinfandel. And he was always say, you know, you drink what you like. You cannot persuade people to drink something they don't like, and nor should you try. So if people want to drink, you know, sweeter red wines or white wines, it's not my business to tell them otherwise.
We've been talking with Sophisticated Living writer and Knapsack Wines owner Neil Charles. We'll talk more with Neil about local food trends later in the show, so stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, we talk a lot here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio about chefs and restaurants, but the food community in Indianapolis extends well beyond the dining scene. One of the most interesting events, I think, is the Food Swap, which has found plenty of fans. I talked to Indy Food Swappers founder Suzanne Kroyak recently to find out just what exactly is a food swap and how they work.
Well, a food swap is remarkably like its name in that a group of people show up and we swap food. We swap things we like to make. Really, the only guidelines are that it's either homemade, homegrown, or foraged, but foraging is not a wild pastime. And some people do it in Indianapolis, but we haven't really seen that at our food swaps. Mostly what we see are people who have made things themselves, anything from, you know, pickles, jams, to breads, their favorite cookie recipe, teas, sourdough starters. Honestly, from Chex Mix to you name it, and it's probably been at one of our food swaps.
I think that's interesting, because I came to the very first one, yes. And I had chocolate chip cookies, but I felt like, well, you know, this is more than a cookie exchange, but that might be an idea that people might understand. You know, how you bring cookies to a cookie exchange and you go home with something. And the food swap is like kind of like that, but so much more.
It's exactly like that, and that you bring And also the way cookie swaps traditionally work is you take home what you bring. So if you bring, you know, 6 dozen cookies, you leave with 6 dozen cookies, but different ones than the ones you made yourself. And that's also the way the food swap works. So it's a one-to-one swap and you take home what you bring. So if you go, you know, one of the early food swaps, a woman, she just brought a pie. She brought one pie, and she left with something. Now, I think she probably wouldn't do that. We have had other people who do that, and they will maybe make a pie, and they'll package 3 really good slices of pie and swap that so they can break it up and get more for their pie buck, so to speak. So it is that where you go and you swap what you have. So one of the most frequently asked questions I have is, well, how much do I bring to a food swap? And my answer really is just to tell them, well, it's a one-to-one swap, so you'll bring whatever you want to take home. And so people generally bring anywhere from 6 things to swap up to maybe 12 or 18 or more. I would say the average is between 8 and 10. And by that I mean not 8 to 10 different things, although certainly you can do that. But let's say you are making cookies and that's what you're swapping. You would package up your cookies, maybe 4 cookies in a bag or some sort of, some people put them in Ziplocs, some people get very creative where it looks like it could be sold in a really high-end food, the artisan shop. So then you would take maybe 8 to 10 packages of cookies, and that's what you would swap.
Tell me how that works, how you get to actually swap your thing for somebody else's.
So what we do is everybody who arrives, and we do our swaps at City Market in downtown Indianapolis, and everybody gets a little table, and they set up what they brought. It is a ticketed event, so you can't just show up and participate. We have we cap it at 35 people. Generally, the tickets become available 2.5 to 3 weeks before the swap and tend to go quickly. And so you have to have a ticket to participate. So you come with your ticket and with your items, set up on a small table, and then everybody gets what's called a bid sheet. And it's not a silent auction, but that's the imagery I use often to explain it to people, where it's a sheet of paper. So everybody sets everything up. They set out their what we call bid sheets, this one piece of paper. And then everybody walks around and takes a look at what else is available, what's interesting to them. And so then what you do is, so if I go and I try someone's shortbread cookies and I'm the one who brought some jars of jam, then I would write down, let's say, Jolene, you brought your, if I recall, salted chocolate chip cookies, right, which were very good. And I want to trade my jar of, you know, ground cherry jam for a package of your cookies, then I would write my name on your bid sheet and I would write what I'm offering to swap. So I would write my name, Suzanne, ground cherry jam. So we spend, you know, 20 minutes to half an hour doing this, where people are walking around, seeing what's available, and then writing down their name on these bid sheets for things that they're interested in swapping. And then after everybody's had a chance to look and see who's interested in their items, we literally almost have a signal, you know, ladies and gentlemen, start your swapping. And then it's difficult to describe if you're not there, and everyone just kind of picks up their things and walks around and swaps. And so as I said, the bid sheets are really a starting point. So just because someone's written their name down, you know, it may be that, you know, on your way to them, you know, other people stopped you and that looked great. And so it's what I tell people is, there may be people that don't want to swap with you. Maybe they have, you know, they don't like chocolate, so they're not interested in the salted chocolate cookies. But so maybe, you know, you maybe don't like ground cherry jam. So I wanted your cookies, but you're not so interested in my jam. So I just like, oh, that's cool. There's someone behind you who has something equally delicious. So I try to tell people not to take it personally, because you aren't obligated to swap with people. It is a barter. It's like, do you like what I have? Great. I like what you have. Let's trade. So one thing I do is really encourage people to not take it personally. If someone doesn't want to swap, it could be a food allergy, food sensitivity, just a food, whatever. Chocolate isn't their thing. Nuts aren't their thing. But people always leave happy.
We've been talking with Indie Food Swappers founder Suzanne Krowiak. For more information, to find out a little bit about what a food swap is and when the next ones are coming up, go to IndieFoodSwappers.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. For this week's Cook This segment, I headed into the home kitchen of private chef Megan McClanahan of HoteLifeIndy.com, where she tackled a protein that is often disparaged.
Okay, so we have the bane of all chefs. We have the ingredient no one likes is the boneless, skinless chicken breast. So tell me, what do you think when you first start thinking about how to do that to make it wonderful?
You know, I think about, okay, what am I going to play with besides the chicken? You know, am I doing a dinner? Am I doing a lunch? Do I want this to be light? What kind of flavors am I thinking? So for instance, today I was thinking brunch, and I like doing kind of sweet and savory dishes. So I think what we're going to do is a beer battered chicken and French toast.
That sounds kind of neat. Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about where you go with that. How do you pull that out of your head?
I was kind of thinking pork tenderloin, since that's what you've been talking about on Facebook. So I kind of had this idea in my mind anyways. I think pre-planning a little bit as much as you can always helps. So, you know, with chicken, it's all about seasoning and, you know, just giving it lots of flavor, keeping it moist.
So tell me what you're doing here.
So I'm just going to split the breast in half, because there's two of us, and make two portions, and then I'm going to pound it out just a little bit thinner to kind of tenderize it as well. And then we're going to dredge it in a beer batter, fry it, and then we'll make our French toast. So I'm just using the flat side of a mallet, just kind of pounding it out a little bit, not too thin, just a little bit.
So you're trying to get it even, is that it?
Yeah, trying to get it even, because like with anything when you're cooking, it's aesthetically looks nicer, and then it cooks more even as well. So this beer that I'm going to use, you can use any lager or an ale is fine. I like to play around with flavored beers. So this is Wells. It's from Denver, Colorado. And it's sticky toffee pudding ale, which, as crazy as it sounds, I think it'll be great for like a breakfast kind of thing. So what we have here is all-purpose flour, baking powder. We've got a little bit of salt and pepper for seasoning, and Jack Daniel's rub, just kind of mixed, just for seasoning. So we're going to add our beer, 12 ounces. And if you don't want to do beer, you can always substitute soda water. And we're going to start on the French toast. I like to cook my French toast, and then I put it in the oven because the egg gets high and fluffy, and it puffs up the French toast and makes it bigger. So we're going to use, we have one loaf of brioche bread, 7 large eggs, and a lot of people will use like Grand Marnier or something in their French toast. I usually do that, but today I'm going to use this raspberry port, just for something different.
So now you've got the eggs.
Got the eggs. So we're going to whisk those together, and then we're going to add, I've got 1.5 cups of heavy whipping cream, 1 cup of whole milk, and I'm going to do about 1/2 cup of the port, about 1/2 teaspoon of cinnamon, and 1 teaspoon of good vanilla extract. The milk. It doesn't have to be perfect, just a good dredging for the toast to soak up, and it should be good to go. It smells great. French toast is one of my favorite foods I grew up on. It was like something my mom always spoiled me with.
So. Well, and it seems perfect for this kind of weather.
Yeah, it's very comforting when it's freezing cold outside, -7 degrees. So a little bit of butter goes in. You want to melt that down just to kind of, for extra flavor, for color, to get that nice golden color that mixes well with the egg. And then obviously to keep it from sticking to your pan as well. Anybody can do this. It's super easy.
So now what are you looking for with the French toast?
I'm looking for it's kind of the golden color. I want to make sure that it's going to cook through once I put it in the oven, but I just want to make sure that it looks pretty, you know, aesthetically. Mm-hmm.
It smells amazing.
I just want to, this French toast is really lucky to be in this pan right now. Oh, it's gorgeous.
So what are we up to now?
Okay, so we're going to start on the chicken. So first, we'll go into the flour. This is just plain little salt and pepper, all-purpose flour. Yep. And shake it off.
And now you're dipping, after you dredge the flour, you're dipping it in the batter that you already made.
Yeah, so like I said, this is all-purpose flour, 12 ounces of beer, in this case, a sticky toffee pudding ale, and baking powder, and then our seasonings. One egg.
Mm-hmm. So now what are you just trying to get it coated really well there?
Just coating it, and then drip off some of the excess because they like to stick to the fryer. And they say the trick is to kind of hold it over the top, just kind of dangle it in, and then let her go.
So now about how long is it going to be in the deep fryer?
It should take about 4 minutes total. Just going to kind of look for a nice brown color. Then we're going to pat it dry, get some of the extra grease off, and then we'll put that in the oven. I've got some pickled vegetables and Havarti cheese. And then we have a peach tarragon Dijon spread that I made for the toast as well. So.
Okay, so that looks beautiful. So now tell me what you were looking for when you were pulling it out.
I'm just looking for that perfect golden color. With beer, it's nice. I mean, you kind of look, that malty beer amber color is really what you're going for. And like I said, giving it enough time where you know that it's cooked through. And so now we're going to just go ahead and start our egg.
The egg you're going to put on top of the whole thing, right?
Yeah, just for fun. It's breakfast, so what's breakfast without eggs? Kind of have to. Now, cooking eggs, I guess the trick is low heat. Takes a little bit longer, but it keeps it that white color without getting all gross around the edges and brown. That was one of the first things that we learned in culinary school was the trick to... the perfect egg. If you can cook an egg, you can cook anything. That's what they say. Do you like your egg kind of runny, or is that okay?
So now tell me about how you're going to plate this.
Okay. So it's just going to be kind of an open-faced. I'm going to take the brioche on the bottom, and then I'm going to spread a little bit of the peach tarragon Dijon on top. And then the chicken will go on top of that, followed by the pork, and then the egg on top of that. Side of pickles.
Tell me what you would call it, and or describe the dish, the completed dish to me.
We're going to call this barbecue drunken chicken and toast. So we've got a brioche French toast with a raspberry port. We have a sticky toffee ale, beer-battered chicken breast topped with Havarti cheese. On top of that, we have bourbon barbecue peach pulled pork, a fried egg, a little drizzle of truffle oil, and a side of pickled vegetables.
We've been cooking with private chef Megan McClanahan. For more info on Megan, you can find her on Facebook or go to HoteLifeIndy.com. With the hope of looking ahead to what's coming in the new year, I sat down recently with local writer and wine business owner Neil Charles, who has written for Nouveau and now writes for Sophisticated Living, and talked a little bit about a few local trends in food,
farmers markets, and the local dining scene.
Food's interesting. We're currently in a heyday of food in this market. I think we enjoyed a similar heyday about 15 years ago, and you and I both remember that time. It's important, I think, for young aspiring chefs these days and also diners to have some sense of history about what has preceded this whole food movement right now that we're enjoying, the farm-to-fork, the local, wouldn't really exist if it hadn't been for pioneers like Peter George, Tony Hanslitz, Richard Cotance, who passed away a few years ago, Greg Hardesty, who was there right at the end of that,
Regina,
who really began, who kind of was in between the two movements.
Exactly.
And this, the former movement, oh, well, Fletcher Boyd as well, we can't forget him, was based not so much around local produce as around quality. And I think restaurants back then were taking quality ingredients, transforming them into something really exceptional, and trying to rival the best of the East and the West Coast. And I know Chez Panisse was a big influence on people. Thomas Keller was a big influence here. Now we're seeing a different kind of chef, chefs of a different stripe, who've not just trained in those kitchens, but have trained at the Chef's Academy. And the emphasis has now moved to local. And I think that's all really admirable. I think it's leading to a bit of homogenization, however, in what we're seeing out there. We're seeing a lot of pigs.
And, we are.
You know, Indiana's famous for pork, so there's a lot of pork out there. Not much attention to seafood being paid, apart from maybe somewhere like Plough and Anchor these days. I'm not sure if the proliferation of food is necessarily leading to an improvement in the quality of what we're eating, though. There are a handful of really exceptional chefs out here in town, I believe. I'm not sure if the dining public is as well informed as maybe it could be about the issues regarding their food. And it's wonderful that we have all these farmers markets and we have some local produce and local meats and that such like. I'm concerned, however, that the farmers markets are something of a kind of bourgeois preoccupation. They make us feel better. We feel good about ourselves because we're eating locally. But organic is not necessarily better in terms of taste. It might be better in terms of nutritional value. And I don't think we're addressing the problems of feeding the vast majority of the population. So the dining public and the restaurant profession and people like myself are in danger, I think, of becoming myopic and losing the big picture. And I would refer people to read a book, for instance, like Jay Rayner's wonderful A Greedy Man in a Hungry World, which sets, I think, the record straight as far as global agriculture and the transportation of food and carbon miles and all that sort of thing. As far as our daily food is concerned, it's very easy to paint ourselves into a cozy little corner, which we are doing. And that's really my nouveau hat speaking.
How do you see our local restaurant culture, our restaurant scene progressing?
Well, as we said earlier, there are a lot of pigs around. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of pork on menus. Again, without, you know, throwing out any challenges, I would like to see more in-house production of pig-related products if that's the way people want to go. I've got a couple of favorite restaurants in California, in Sonoma, where they make all their own sausages, they make their own hams, they make their own cheeses, in fact. When I started in the restaurant business back in the early 80s, the restaurant I was with was reviewed in the Good Food Guide, and the Good Food Guide had one very clear standard, which was that restaurants could not use any processed food. I think that is a criterion to which I'd like to see more restaurateurs adhere. We have this incredible resource in town, Smoking Goose, and I think Chris Ely has done a phenomenal job with elevating the standard of charcuterie in Indianapolis, and with really putting the word out that Indy can be a source of, you know, world-class meats and wonderful comestibles. However, it's also become a crutch, I think, on which a lot of lesser restaurants are resting.
The Smoking Goose charcuterie board.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, the Smoking Goose charcuterie board, which is almost ubiquitous. Now, that's not a bad thing, but I'd love to see that created in-house. There's a restaurant in London, which I think everybody should go to at least once, called St. John. And in 1994, when it opened, Fergus Henderson, the chef, he created the nose-to-tail movement. And nose-to-tail basically came to the Indianapolis market 3 years ago when Micah, Frank, and Ed Rudisell opened Black Market. Micah has done an incredible job, I think, at trying to expose us to more of the animal. But there are very, very few restaurants outside the ethnic restaurants, you know, on the west side particularly, who are taking advantage of this great bounty. I think Carlos Salazar Rook is another one who's doing this. We have all these amazing four-legged animals, these wonderful pigs, which are grown in various farms around the state. But we're only eating, you know, from the thighs upwards, basically, high on the hog. And I would love to see better education of both customers and restaurateurs when it comes to using the entire animal. And I think this is a barrier that we absolutely have to break. If we're talking about sustainability and about farmers' markets and about being responsible in our eating habits, I think we personally owe it to ourselves and to the animals that we kill to eat more of them. So I would definitely like to see more of that.
Any trends in food in general that you think we will see in 2015? Are we done with kale? Are we done with cupcakes? Anything that you've spotted or would like to see go away?
I wouldn't mind seeing cupcakes go south, to be honest. I'd like to see more natural wines on wine lists, definitely. I'd like to see fewer of the big behemoths populating the wine culture. I'd like to see hoppy IPAs go away too, actually. And I know it's easy and it's, you know, relatively, you know, simple to make a big hoppy IPA, and I come from a brewing family, but I'd like to see a little bit more diversity in what we drink. And as far as culinary culture, there's something I'm quite a bit afraid of coming to town, and that's the sort of menu you might encounter in Chicago or on the East Coast, where a dish is essentially just a long list of ingredients with no real focus. And I know there's a name for it, but I can't remember the name right now. Essentially, you don't really know what you're going to get. There will be just a range of things that the chef has sourced, quote-unquote, and unfortunately, a lot of chefing these days seems to be as much about finding ingredients as it is about assembling them. I hope that doesn't really make a big impact here. I would actually, sticking my neck out further, I would like to see more cooking. I am concerned about how much food these days is merely a presentation of something on a plate, which is not accompanied by a sauce or a particularly interesting preparation. I was brought up, you know, to expect things like soufflés and pâtés and terrines and beurre blanc, and I have a sort of short list of items which I think chefs ought to be able to prepare. And the next Iron Chef thing that we do, I would love to see some, you know, let's make a soufflé, let's make a beurre blanc, let's make a crème brûlée and see, you know, see how it goes.
We've been talking with writer Neil Charles of Sophisticated Living and Knapsack Wines. You can find Neil Charles on Facebook and Twitter, or for wine info, go to knapsackwines.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Among the many food trends we've seen gain momentum recently, the do-it-yourself movement seems to be one of the strongest. I sat down recently with master food preserver Suzanne Krowiak, who also founded Indie Food Swappers,
to talk about what she sees ahead for the DIY crowd.
Are you seeing any trends in sort of the do-it-yourself interest in food? I know you make a lot of jams. You have the food swap, of course. Anything that we can expect to see more of maybe in 2015?
You know, I feel like condiments have always been a big part of the DIY food movement, and it just seems to be, that seems to be an ongoing thing. Maybe the condiment that people are swooning over changes from year to year. Last year, everyone was really making their own sriracha. That was like, people really want to make their own sriracha. I don't know why that happened all of a sudden, but it did. And, you know, I think what happens is then people start reading about other people making their own sriracha. And so this year, I feel like harissa, this may be the year of harissa. People are interested in making that. And just any kind of condiments. Charcuterie is still big. Cheese trays are still big. And anytime you go to your favorite locally owned restaurant or place, there, you know, there's a lot of focus there on these cheese boards and charcuterie boards. And I've noticed, you know, a lot of the chefs are doing some of their own house-made condiments with these boards. I think people go and that inspires them to make their own. So I still think condiments are a big thing. You know, pickling there's been this resurgence mm-hmm. in the last few years of pickling, which I think continues, but I also think there is a really heavy interest. It's not moving from pickling, but the interest in fermenting is getting greater. You know, making your own kimchi, making your own sauerkraut, those things which are pickled products, but it's a different process and it's, you know, involves probiotic components that people are more interested in that you can achieve through fermentation that you can't achieve through a quick pickling process. So I continue to hear a lot of interest in the topic of fermenting and, you know, I still get a lot of people still want to learn to can, you know, people are, it's, even though it's been this, I feel like it's been 3 to 5 years of really heavy interest, again, a resurgence in canning and preserving. People still want to do that. And I just think people are interested in whether it's homemade Nutella, sriracha, harissa, jams. People seem to be more interested in doing things themselves, seeing if they can do it, controlling what goes in, you know, into their pantry, having a little more control over that. And just people are, I think, once you, it's like a gateway, you know, you do your first homemade whatever, and then you're on the lookout, like you're scanning the landscape for what's the next thing I want to do myself. So I just kind of think that will continue, people being more and more interested in doing it themselves.
Now, is it, do you think it's something easy enough for people to just sort of pick up and do? You know, you mentioned, you know, the pickling, you know, is kind of where people maybe start. Mm-hmm. And then going into the fermentation stuff, you know, is it an easy thing, easy hobby to sort of pick up?
You know, I think it is if you, there are so, because of the resurgence in interest, there are a lot of resources out there. I started canning, a few years ago, and it was because I saw a cookbook that was beautiful and looked, that would be great Christmas gifts. And it was the Blue Chair Jam cookbook, I believe. And so I just kind of taught myself that way. And then I ended up getting my Master Food Preserver certificate through Purdue. But I taught myself through this book. And so there are many books on the market. There are some wonderful websites. Food in Jars is a great one. Punk Domestics is another sort of, they have links to whatever DIY food project you want. So I certainly think between the resources that are available online and at the library and at your bookstore, if you have an interest, now you can't just magically wake up in your kitchen and be like, I shall can today. You're going to have to do some reading. There are also lots of videos online. But if you are willing to do just a little bit of research and a little bit of reading, it's certainly accessible to everyone. You don't have to go take a Master Food Preserver program to be able to make your own pickles and jam at home.
Now, do you see some trends, any more trends coming in maybe what people are interested in making or things that you would like to see more people dip their toes into the water of?
I feel like there is an interest online for people who have been preserving or making their own things for a while to think out of the box a little bit on. So, for instance, I noticed, you know, there you shared on social media this herb jam, which looked amazing and now is on my list that I must, you know, need to obsess over. So I think it's going to be, how can we continue to tweak these really well-known, these familiar recipes and make them, the flavor profiles, more interesting to people who are, you know, used to going to restaurants or making food from cookbooks that are really creative, ambitious. So I think it's going to be, how do we keep pushing this DIY movement forward where, you know, you're continuing to layer flavors, to layer techniques, and keep things interesting, because that is also what happens. The more you do it, the more you want to tweak a little bit. And there's inspiration everywhere for that. You know, the local chefs are providing a lot of that inspiration. And so I think that'll just be it, more the continued pushing the envelope on how do you use these flavors in these old school techniques.
We've been talking with master food preserver and jam maker extraordinaire Suzanne Krowiak. You can follow her on Twitter at Indie Food Swap. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. I'd like to thank our guests this week, Neil Charles of Sophisticated Living and Knapsack Wines, Suzanne Krowiak of Indie Food Swappers, Susan Decker for Devour Downtown, Arthur Black of RNDC, Barbie Gale of Harry and Izzy's, and Megan McClanahan of HoteLifeIndy.com. And thanks to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.